Professor Allen's Comics Reading Journal for the month of August, 2020. Welcome to episode 63 of this podcast series, aka Social Distance Reading Journal number 6. Now I am glad to be back to work full time, doing online classes, but still, that sort of counts. This episode is probably going to be a long one, because there were 5 Saturdays in August, and the semester didn't start till late August, and what else is there to do these days other than read comic books? Now, the concept of this show is for us to just have a brief chat about what comics I've read since the last time we had one of these brief chats, which should make this pretty much the books I read during August. These books are listed weekly in blog posts at eyesandearsblog.blogspot.com, and I regularly repost those links on my Facebook and Twitter, so those can easily be found. But don't worry, those posts don't serve as spoilers for this podcast, because those are just lists. And here, we do a little more review, a little more critique, a little more discussion. But first, a little feedback. The excellent former podcaster Michael Bradley wrote in that he was jealous of my finding an issue of World's Finest, no matter what the condition, in a dollar bin. You also mentioned reading Action 338 and 339, trivia you may not know. Correction there, Mr. Bradley. This is trivia I most certainly, positively, did not know whatsoever. He says, the Supergirl backup in 338 was Jerry Siegel's very last ever published story for DC Comics. And the Supergirl backup next issue, 339, was Jim Shooter's first ever published work. And save for one more story in World's Finest the following month, the Superman story in 339 was Edmund Hamilton's last ever published story for DC. Wow. Thank you, Michael. I did not realize how much of a passing of the torch those two issues represented. Interesting stuff. Social media support for last episode came from Robert Ludwig, the most sane man among us, Sir Luke Giaconetti, James Williams, Gene Hendricks from Two True Freaks, Clinton Robinson from Fan Films Friday, Pat from the Long Box Crusade, Vic from Phoenix, Chris Lydon, Derek William Crabb from the Fan Holes, Chris Willette, David Presley, Chris from Professor Frenzy, It's a Show, Billy D., the Young Justice Podcast, Paul from The Collected Edition, Drew from Comics for Fun and Profit, Josh Swenson, Kirk Spencer, Big Five Army, Bill Baer from The Bat Pod, Randy Watts, Kyle Benning, Baby Skeletor, Sir Martin of Grey, and the kind and lovely Sutherlands from the Rad Adventures Network. And now, let's talk about books I read last month. As we do on this show, we categorize those books. And first up are the books that I read specifically for podcast appearances. We call those the homework books. And for Quarterbin 156, I read Teen Titans 100-page giant number 1 from just a few years ago. That's right. One of the Walmart books. I did not get it for a quarter, but it did have a small new Teen Titans story and reprints of Super Sons number 1, Sideways number 1, and the 2003 version of Teen Titans number 1. And for Quarterbin 157, a book that I actually paid 25 cents for, I think maybe even a dime, Battlestar Galactica Steampunk 1880. Number 1. And for the most recent episode of Doomspeak, the 5th month without a new issue of the ongoing, I read Cloak and Dagger number 10, straight out of the 90s. for an upcoming show on the Fortress of Baileytude podcast. I reread the first trade of one of my favorite comic series of all time. 100 Bullets, 1 through 5. And a podcast follow-up from a series I talked about on the Quarterbin show a little while back, the original Ghost Rider Rides Again, number 3. A reprint book containing Ghost Rider 72 and 73, in which the spirit of Ghost Rider, the spirit of vengeance, is fighting hard against Johnny Blaze to come out more often and punish more people, while the carnival that Johnny works at is attacked by the circus of crime. Drama, action, and a couple of pretty good stories. Another follow-up, for 50 cents from Pulp Reality, another issue of a sci-fi anthology series that I covered on Quarterbin 137. So when I saw the first issue of Time Warp, I thought, let's do that again. And comics I read for listening to podcasts. And there are more of these than ever before because DC Universe app. I love following along with comic book podcasts if I have the chance, and the app gives me more opportunities than ever to have that chance. So, to listen along with episode 394, part 2 of the Superman Fan Podcast hosted by Billy Hogan, I read Action Comics 334, a reprint issue focusing on Supergirl. And I listen along with Rob Myers and the crew on Robin Everyone Loves the Drake, episode 118. I read Detective Comics 697 through 699, some Chuck Dixon and Graham Nolan goodness. And to follow along with Kirk and the crew at Third Degree Burn, episode 52, I read from the John Byrne run, of course, Superman 22. And to listen along with episode 30 of Batman Nightcast, I read Detective Comics 473 and 474, right from the Steve Englehart Marshall Rogers run. And to listen along with episodes 80 and 81 of The Legion Clubhouse, I read again from the DCU app Superboy and the Legion of Superheroes 225, 226, and 227, a run that included the introduction of Dawnstar. And I think sometimes she gets swept up with the Tyrock introduction and gets forgotten. I mean, there's a lot of things that, you know, Tyrock is best forgotten in a lot of ways. But there's a lot about Dawnstar that I think can be used in future iterations and have been. So I think that more modern reboots have helped rehabilitate Dawnstar's reputation. And to listen to Sean and Greg on the Never-Ending Reading Pile, episode 4 of that, I think it was. I read All-Star Squadron 44. And for listening along with Tim Price, the Podcrasher, in his debut, Maiden Voyage on the Outcaster Show, which he does with Ashford. For episode 0, I read Brave and the Bold 200 from 1983. That's one of the things I like about following along with people's podcasts when they're covering DC books that I can get on the app, is that it opens me up to such a wide variety of books and certainly allows serendipity to happen. And I thoroughly enjoy that. All right, let's get to the new comics that we read right off the shelves. And we actually don't have any in terms of like physical copies of new issues, but what we do have is the latest issue of a series I'm reading off Hoopla, which is being released on that service to the same date as the physical on sale book. So I am counting Adler, number 3. Irene and her team of Victorian heroines, including Miss Havisham and Jane Eyre, have received papers from Marie Curie describing the nature of radiation. But some of her notes have been stolen by their nemesis, Queen Aisha, who has also stolen Nikola Tesla, meaning that she has within her powers the means of creating, that's right, a death ray. And it seems to actually pretty much work, so our hero ladies find that they have hands that are very, very full. And like I said, that's it for new books, so on to the general comic reading that I did. Mike the Peacock Peacock of Justice's First Dawn and Count Dante's Black Dragon Society is getting out of the podcasting game, at least for a while. And as part of that, or related to that, I think, he's downsizing his comic book collection a bit. And I was the very fortunate recipient of some of his generosity, receiving a good-sized box of comics and trades. Very generous, Mike. Thank you. And among those books were Extreme Hero, a 1994 preview for upcoming Extreme Comics. And based on these previews, they definitely live up to that name. They were comics. And they were extreme! I can definitely see what the Peacock was thinking with this one. I mean, if I had this one in my collection, and I wanted to downsize said collection, this would definitely be one of the first ones to go. Vengeance Squad number 5 from Modern Comics, Two-Fisted Action from 1977. Pretty good adventure story about an international team of do-gooders. Typical small press art and coloring. Those were a bit disappointing. But overall, this one was more entertaining than I expected. Mike also sent a couple issues of a black and white manga from Viz. Fist of the North Star, Part 2, Issues 7 and 8. I'm not huge into manga, but this one seemed to have all the requisite drama and soap opera and fighting that I expected, so what more could you want? Mike also sent Who's Who in Star Trek 1 and 2 from 1987. They were a blast to flip through, and I'm very excited to pass these on later in the year to my brother-in-law, a huge Star Trek fan. Just don't tell Phil Jr. about that, okay? From the generous Canadian Rob Lance of the Comic Connection store in Oakville, Ontario, I read Ghost Rider number 4 from way back in 1973, complete with a 20-cent cover price. Now, this was obviously, being number 4, very early in the run, and at this point, Johnny changed every night into his fiery Skulled alter ego. I don't think I'd ever read any Ghost Rider from this early in the comics history, and I enjoyed this one quite a bit. Sir Iowa's Joe sent in some comics recently, including one of the better PSA comics I've ever read. American Honda Presents Supergirl, which was about traffic safety in general and the value of wearing seatbelts in particular. The key was that the comic itself is able to work in aliens and different time periods in a way that, you know, for a comic book works, you know, sort of makes sense. And the message is a good one. And in 1984, a very much needed one. Speaking of Supergirl, Dr. Ange took time out of his busy schedule blogging at Comics Box Commentary and doing that side gig he has of like an emergency room physician, something like that, to send me a fun pack of comics, including Adventure 481, right at the very start of the Dial H era. As you may know, I am a huge fan of this version of that property, and covered a bunch of them on the quarter bin a few years back. I like that they worked in some continuity, both throughout the three stories in this issue, and also from issue to issue, which adds a bit of narrative punch to the kid-friendly nature of the stories. My favorite reader-created character in this one, it's one of the villains, the Destructress, which I just think is kind of a cool name. And he sent Adventure Man number 1, a current book from Image, from Matt Fraction and the Dotsons? The surprise is that the lead character is not, in fact, a man, but a woman inspired by and living in the legacy of the pulp hero Adventure Man. Claire Connell runs her family's used bookstore business, another legacy, and through a series of strange occurrences, comes to believe that Adventure Man's adventures may be ready to continue with her in the lead. It's a crazy idea, a good first issue, and props to Image for producing a 50-plus page-long debut issue at the regular price of $3.99. And Godzilla, number 3, from the 1977 Marvel run, S.H.I.E.L.D. and the Champions, we're talking Iceman, Black Widow, Hercules, they go up against Godzilla, who's working on taking down San Francisco. It's just a nice change of pace, as far as I'm concerned, to read Marvel stories that take place somewhere other than New York City. So the setting alone made this one worth the read. But obviously, for better coverage of this issue, I heartily recommend episode 46 of Earth Destruction Directive, hosted by good friend of the network, Sir Luke of the Upstate. And Ange also sent Savage Wolverine number 3 from 2013. From what I can tell, reading a bunch of mismatched or disconnected Marvel books from this era, is that Amadeus Cho was a bigger thing than I realized. He's the driving force in this story, which ends with Wolverine and Shanna the She-Devil taking over the story, and that is when it gets quite savage. Mike Lane from Comics in the Golden Age sent me a comic from the Bronze Age, Doctor Strange number 11. In this one, the master of the mystic arts finds himself battling in a swirl of shifting shadows. He's battling death in many different forms, including some forms that closely resemble Stephen himself. And all the while, Baron Mordo is putting his plans together for causing much havoc. Doc does escape the magic realm, spoilers, and next issue, I guess, he and Baron will clash. Now, I got a book from that total fanhole, Derek W.C., Silver Surfer number 2 from the Dan Slott run from 2014. Norrin Rand at this point is a free agent with the power cosmic at his disposal. And he has been drafted by the incredulous Zed to protect his world. But somehow the Earth Girl Dawn Greenwood gets involved. And at the end of the issue, both the Surfer and Dawn are convinced that they need to rescue each other. And for my old buddy Ron Sadowski, I read Retief, number 3, a black and white comic from Adventure / Malibu from 1990. I recently read a short story featuring this character and remembered somewhere that I had a comic featuring the same guy. I liked the setup of the stories. It's a sci-fi guy who's a negotiator, a diplomat, a business wheeler-dealer. And his stories take place just in a wide range of sci-fi settings. So it's entertaining, and it was a very adventurous change of pace for a sci-fi comic book series. And from Tom Panarese, who continues his uncollecting process, I read Time Bandits, the movie special, which I'm pretty sure I read a copy of a couple of years ago also. This is a movie from 1980, which I didn't see until 1988 or so. And I remember who we saw it with. It was Mike and Linda, who were the first close adult friends that me and Mrs. Quarterbin made as young adult-type people. Very fun movie with all of the Monty Python-adjacent wackiness that you would expect from a film directed by Gilliam, written by Gilliam and Palin, and starring Cleese. Sean Connery, Shelley Duvall, and Ian Holm were also in the film. And as fun as the film is, the adaptation manages to capture a lot of that spirit of the film. Of course, like I said, I'm probably biased because I have really pleasant memories of the film and watching the film with those close friends. Last episode, I talked about a series of miscellaneous issues of Doc Savage comics I picked up from Millennium Comics, and Kirk Spencer sent me another one, Doc Savage, The Man of Bronze, number 3. Good story, although the coloring in this one was a bit more off-putting than ones that I read last time. But overall, I enjoyed the character and his cast, and more often than not, enjoy the comic books he starred in, no matter which publisher had the license at any particular time. Kirk also sent an extra-sized DC book from 1992, The Titans Sellout Special. I didn't have any context whatsoever for this, not having read any Team Titans from this era, but it was sort of a standalone. The Titans find themselves having been driven out of New York City, mostly because they have really been responsible for a heck of a lot of damage there. So they end up on the West Coast and somehow manage to make some merchandising deals, licensing deals, including a pilot for a cartoon about them, or kiddified versions of them. And the back half of this comic is a 20-page adaptation, quote-unquote, of that pilot episode, which was pretty darn hilarious. And it was hilarious at all that it was included. Very much fun and totally surprising and out of the blue. When the protests were getting started back in June, a list of black-owned comic shops went around, and I saw that one of them was here in Columbus, Crazy Comics. So I've been a couple of times recently to spend a certain amount of money there, because that is one thing that I can tangibly do. I believe the economy, the free market, can be a powerful force for social change. And from the dollar bins there, I bought Dick Tracy Book 1. This was a 3-part set of square-bound 48-page issues. And it does lead into number 2, I guess. But, and this is a good thing, it did tell a full story start to finish. This one was called Big City Blues and had a good amount of the classic Tracy supporting cast. And it featured the artwork of Kyle Baker, whose overly stylized approach totally fits for Dick Tracy. And I picked up a book from a DC event from about 5 years ago, or in DC terms, 9 3/4 reboots ago. It intrigued me, but also confused me. But when I saw Multiversity Society of Superheroes, I thought I'd take a shot. And I think I prefer Grant Morrison when he, like this, is just given a corner of the DCU to go hog wild in, sort of his own version of an Elseworlds. His wild imagination needs some structure, needs some rules, and it needs to be kept away from the rest of the DCU, where, you know, things like characterization and continuity kind of matter. And in this series, although the intent and purpose of it is long gone, in terms of where, you know, the current DCU is, I mean, but, and maybe even because of that, I have to admit, I'm kind of intrigued by the series. And if I find more for cheap, or just need something to read one day when I'm messing around on the DCU app, I may just revisit Multiversity. And another from an interesting series I discovered last month from DC, Solo Tim Sale. This one contained 6 short stories, 2 written by Sale himself, that show the range of the man's artistic skill. We start with a bang-up Batman-Catwoman story written by Darwin Cook, a couple of the great ones with a Supergirl story, Young Love, and a noir crime story written by Azzarello. Very enjoyable, and I just think it's so cool that DC did this little odd series. Morlock, 2001 and The Midnight Men, number 3, an Atlas comic from 1975. Of the indie books from that era, I think Atlas may have been the best, at least in terms of seeming to be most like DC's and Marvel's of the era. the writers, the art, the printing process, the paper quality. It was all pretty close. Which is why they went out of business so quickly, because all of that quality, writing, art, printing, paper, all of that stuff costs real money and makes their break-even point way higher than I imagine Gold Key or Charlton's were. And so when they couldn't reach those heights of sales, they couldn't make it. And from the 50-cent boxes of Pulp Reality, where I picked up a big haul of books, I read Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, number 6, from 1966, a Gold Key title based on the TV show of the same name. This one featured a story about having to take a submarine overland to get it from one body of water to another. It was adventurous, dramatic, and exciting. And what more can you ask for? And Superman Family, 176, which featured Jimmy Olsen in the lead, where he became a country singer in Nashville to bust a racket. And he became famous singing a hit song written by Superman's computer at the Fortress of Solitude. Okay. Crypto, Supergirl, and Lois Lane served as the leads in the other stories, which were generally more enjoyable than that one. And from World's Greatest Comics, books that cost me anywhere from a buck down to 10 cents, I read Action Comics 461, an issue I remember reading back in the day. This is the one where Carr Brack first appears as a refugee from his planet. The only problem with Earth for him is that he's allergic to Superman. This is probably better known as the issue that leads into the issue of Superman being punched back to 1776. Fury, 50 Years of S.H.I.E.L.D. from 2015. Sam Jackson, Nick Fury, goes back in time to stop the hate monger from assassinating a future leader and runs across the David Hasselhoff version of Nick Fury. And Junior knows the relationship, but Senior does not. And New Talent Showcase number 1 from 1984. That was an interesting time capsule, as most of the stories that these new talents created were not hero books. They were all fantasy or sci-fi of some manner or other. Not sure what that means exactly, but I thought it was something worth noting. And we've got a lot of kids' books here, mostly from Sir Rob's care package, but also some from Sir I Was Joe, some from Ed Moore, a few from Pulp Reality. And I read, like I said, a lot. Sad Sacks, Funny Friends, 55, 58, and 62. Sugar and Spike, number 10. Walt Disney, Mickey Mouse, 110 and 116. Richie Rich, 115, 167, 172, and 184. The Roman Holidays, number 4. Treasure Chest of Fun and Fact, volume 20, number 12. And Walt Disney Comics and Stories, volume 27, 5, 6, 8, and 9. And volume 29, number 5. Sad Sack's Funny Friends was a title that focused on the character of the general and getting some army humor from that perspective, as opposed to the low-level Sad Sack. Interesting idea. And I've talked about this before, but I have to mention it again because it is a mind-blowing comic book fact. But according to a house ad in one of the issues of Richie Rich, in December 1979, Harvey published 16 titles that month. 13 and a half of the 16 were Richie Rich books. That left one for Sad Sack, one for Hot Stuff, and that shared Richie Rich and Casper book. 13 and a half Richie Rich titles in a month. I just think that Batman looked at the house ad and said, "Don't worry, buddy. In just 3.5 short decades, you can hold my beer." Ed Moore sent the Disney comics, the comics and stories, and they were excellent. They even had some Disney crossovers, with Mickey Mouse helping out Pinocchio in one story, for example. And Sugar and Spike has to get special notice, because as I told Keith from World's Greatest Comics, when I pulled this out of the box on a sale day, I don't care if it doesn't have a cover. Yes, I'll pay 10 cents to read a 63-year-old kitty comic. Anytime. And one more book needs attention here, because last month I opined about Treasure Chest of Fun and Fact, how it must have been designed for schools and pediatricians' waiting rooms. But reading this issue, though, a few tumblers clicked into place. This doesn't just have regular historical content. I mean, it has that. But a lot of that content is religious, Catholic in particular. And just a little digging turned up the fact that this was indeed a Catholic publication, with the publisher only about 75 miles away from me in Dayton, Ohio. So how about that? And of course, this just speaks to my interest, and I'm not going to get all darkness to light on us here. But for me, that fact just made me even more intrigued about this title. All right, time to take a break here, and when we come back, we'll talk about graphic novels, trade paperbacks, and long runs that I read in August.
Hey everybody, Clinton Robinson here. I recently attempted to sneak into the Longbox Crusade headquarters basement to watch some of the Albrecht Brothers action movies while the crew was out at the Saturday matinee theater. Too bad I had a little mishap and got stuck down here. With no movies to boot! However, there are pieces of Pat's old podcasting equipment and excellent Wi-Fi service, so I decided to pass the time watching online fan films and talking about them. What, you don't know what a fan film is? Well, there are these non-theatrical movies that people post online of already established characters and settings. Hey, now. Just wait and see. Save all judgment for what happens when you listen to Fan Film Fridays, a new podcast found on the Longbox Crusade podcast feed.
And we're back. Talk about trades, long runs, and miniseries that I read last month. If you listened to the show over the last year or so, you know how much I've read from the Edgar Rice Burroughs licenses, from a variety of publishers, variety of decades. And from the 50-cent bins at Pulp Reality, I recently grabbed a bunch of these books from the 70s, Tarzan Family, 65 from DC, and from Marvel, John Carter, Warlord of Mars, 3, 4, 5, 7, 8, and 9. I have a deep and abiding love for all of the DC family titles, from Superman and Batman and Super Team, and here, Tarzan. That issue featured stories of Korak, son of Tarzan, two stories of Carson of Venus, and a 4 or 5 page origin for John Carter. Good read, and plenty of good stories for 50 cents. The John Carter Marvel books were based on a original ERB story, The Air Pirates of Mars. Enjoyable, adventurous, it has the main key Carter characters, and it's not a bad way to have gotten that comic series off to a start. But my reading of the John Carter comics has been so haphazard. Tarzan and Conan fit this category as well. That it's hard to tell if I'm familiar with this story, The Air Pirates of Mars, because I've read one that's similar, or because I've read another publisher's version of that story under a different license. That has definitely happened with Tarzan. Or it's possible I've read these exact John Carter 1970s Marvel issues before. And for all I know, maybe this just rings a bell because I've heard of this story. And you have to admit that the title, Air Pirates of Mars, is pretty darn memorable. Now, for someone who values organization and structure as much as I do, and who reads almost everything in order, not just comics, but novel series, including these novel series. There's just something about these old-timey licensed comic properties that both make it difficult, and also maybe because it's difficult and complex how much the licenses have bounced around between so many different publishers, that somewhere deep down for these types of series, I just think that the structure and the organization doesn't matter or isn't worth the effort. It's weird. I mean, I'll just grab whatever issues of Tarzan or Conan or John Carter and read them. I mean, my attitude toward these properties is so wildly different from my approach to almost everything else. I'm not totally sure why. I'm confessing that it's weird. When you discover something about yourself that just doesn't fit in with everything else you know about yourself, that's just weird. Okay, I'm going to get off the psychologist's couch now and just keep talking about comic books, if that's okay with the rest of you. From the combination of Pulp Reality, Tom Paneris, and Mike Peacock, I read from the 1992 DC run, Star Trek 24, 34, and 50. Now, two of these, 24 and 50, were extra length, as issue 24 celebrated the 25th anniversary of the show, and also had some essays in the back. A very nice anniversary issue, actually. But then 50 contained, I think, my favorite story of these three, where Gary Seven and his cat Isis return to enlist the Enterprise in Gary's battles with other rebels like himself against his own organization. Interesting story and a good take on all the characters. I hadn't read much of this run, but these issues were pleasantly solid. And sticking with the sci-fi theme, I picked up a couple of issues of a classic DC anthology title, two different volumes actually, both for 50 cents at Pulp Reality. This is Strange Adventures 238 and Strange Adventures Vertigo number 1. That one was from 2011. I actually preferred the older one more, and not just because it had a good long Adam Strange story. I mean, that did help. I mean, that helped a lot. And from the combination of Pulp Reality and the DCU app, I read DC 1 million, 1 through 4, and The 80-Page Giant. I've read a handful of the individual issues in this event, but had never hit these, I guess, core story issues. And overall, I thought they were pretty fun. I really did like the premise. There was logic to it all, that Vandal Savage and Resurrection Man would be among the characters who could possibly exist throughout time. And among the folks that jumped through time, the Huntress was on that team, and she's one of my favorite underrated heroes, so I enjoyed that as well. Good event, good stories. It helps that I treat big events like this just like they're Elseworlds. I think I mentioned that before with Multiversity. It helps that I don't get hung up in the continuity aspects of big, sprawling stories like this. That really helps my enjoyment, I'm sure. And from the combination of Sir I Was Joe and the DCU app, I read the storyline Superman and the Legion of Superheroes from 2010. This is an Action Comics 858 to 863. In this version of the future, our sun has turned red. That was caused by a villain siphoning off Sunboy's powers. So when Superman arrives, because he was invited there by the Legion, he ends up powerless. And by the year 3000 or so, he learns that public knowledge of him is very distorted. The lie of Superman being a stinking alien from Krypton? That's been dismissed by historians as legend. Instead, Superman is a heroic Earthling protecting Earth from all sorts of aliens, especially those in the Legion of Superheroes. It's a very good story. Nice to see a modern take on the Legion that I more or less approved of. And the backstory about the change in Superman's history or public perceptions of his history, I think that's a really good story idea. and speaks to the malleability of history and the inherent caution and humility that we should take when making proclamations about what happened in the past. And from the combination of Crazy Comics and Sir I Was Jill, I read three more issues of a First Comics series that I've read a couple of issues of, starting back in Quarter Bin 100, and that is Warp 1, 2, and 8. I liked 1 and 2 a lot, and evidently a lot happened between 2 and 8 because a lot of the plot was different by the time I got to that latter issue, but it was still a good issue, and I learned something reading through the back matter in issues 1 and 2, that Warp is actually based on a theater production from almost a decade before. And I can't honestly say if I know of a lot of other comic books that began their life on the stage. From the combination of Sir Luke Giaconetti and the Public Library, I read FF 2 through 5. That wrapped up the first trade, and then I skipped to another issue that Luke sent, FF 7. And I'm saying that a ton must have happened around issue 6, or maybe a Marvel event happened in the interim, because the first batch of issues were solid, with Doom taking an appropriately central role. But at the end of 5, and then totally in 7, it's all Inhumans all the time. And they also lost Steve Epting as artist, at least for issue 7. Now, he's not there. But obviously the big question is, what happened to Doom? I mean, it's a shame that hashtag Big Comic obviously got to Jonathan Hickman. Whether it was blackmail or bribery, it was obviously something serious to take the direction of this title such a different and unwarranted direction. Because that first trade with Valeria, bringing Doom into the family, with the damage we've seen that the Council of Reeds has done to all of time and space, the story had so much potential, not just as a comic, but as a learning tool. And then, no more Doom? Failing. Hashtag sad. And from Sir I Was Joe, who along with Kirk Spencer is part of the DC Everything Else podcast, I read the Vertigo era version from the mid-90s of Animal Man, 81, 82, and 86. What a bunch of weird, strange, bizarre issues. This was Jerry Prosser writing, and that's a name that didn't mean much to me. But you've got two key elements to keep track of when you're writing Animal Man, and these issues do get both of those. You've got the connection to the Red, and in this case, we see it sort of manifesting through animal dreams that people are having. And the second thing you have to keep track of is Buddy and his family. And here, it's the daughter Maxine that sort of takes the center stage. She's become a celebrity for her connection to those dreams. And there's a lot of weird stuff happening all around that. Sir I Was Joe also sent in Voracious 1, and then Voracious Appetite for Destruction 1 through 5 from Action Lab. The shorthand setup for the series is that Nate leaves New York for Utah, where he has some family after a tragic experience in the Big Apple. His passion is food, and through a strange series of circumstances involving a late uncle who Nate wasn't especially close to, he learns that he can travel to the past. And he also discovers that dinosaur meat is really, like, really yummy. And then 9 issues passed in between before picking up Appetite for Destruction, which brought this 15-issue epic story to a close. And a lot did happen in between there, including some time travel and alternate dimensions and dinosaur societies, sped up evolution, and that's just a bit of what must have happened in those intervening issues. But once I figured out what kind of crazy world this story was happening in, I was able to get into this and really enjoyed it. Marcus San Nasso and Jason Moore did a really good job creating an intriguing premise, crazy stories, interesting characters, and delivered a satisfying ending. And as we always say around here, endings are hard. And from my buddy down in Georgia, the aforementioned Kirk Spencer, I read ElfQuest 12 through 14 from the Marvel Epic run. This is a title I've read bits and bobs of over the years, but never a good long run. Or at least it's been a long time since I've sat down and read a good long run. And this doesn't necessarily meet their criteria, just three issues in a row. But being able to get issues in a row of ElfQuest is really good, because this is long-form epic. You really need to get some continuity from story to story. I'm pretty sure that Hoopla has a bunch of these, and at some point I really do need to sit down and read and or reread a big bunch of these, because every time I sit down and read one or two or three issues of ElfQuest, I'm struck anew by just how good this all is. I mentioned Mike Peacock in the first half of the episode. His care package included some excellent trades, including a two-volume set called Absolute Vision, which tells, well, according to the back of the first volume, the ultimate Vision story. And it does more than that, laying in a lot of Avengers and general Marvel background, before getting into the Vision-centric stories. Overall, the first volume contained Amazing Spider-Man Annual 16, Fantastic Four 256, Doctor Strange 60, and Avengers 231 to 241, and Annuals 11 and 12. The collection started slowly in terms of the Vision stuff. Like I said, it laid in a lot of groundwork for this version of the team, introducing both Star Fox and Monica Rambeau, then slowly getting around to the story of Vision being laid low by Annihilus's barrier that he has thrown up around the Baxter Building. He snuck into our world from the Negative Zone when the FF headed into the zone because, you know, they're pretty careless. There was a really nice parallelism in Avengers 233 and the FF issue, which have identical final pages, or at least they have identical script. The art is different, but they are clearly working off of, like I said, the same script. It's a really nice touch if you're reading both of these issues. That was just an impressive little bit of continuity. And this dips in and out of the other titles. How it did that worked really well. The FF issue, the Doc Strange issue, they fit into this whole epic Avengers tale. Now, for these issues, I just read the first volume. Most of what happened takes place around the Vision. I mean, a lot of it is around his coma. But I really liked a lot of what was happening here, and certainly am a huge fan of Wanda. I've mentioned this more than once on the network, but Scarlet Witch was my first major comic book crush, and I still have that crush on her. So Vision is recovering as this trade wraps up with the help of Star Fox and access that he had to a big mega computer on Titan. But Vision has taken over the computer workings of Avengers Mansion, and a few folks are a little bit worried about that, actually. I expect to work on the next volume of the trade next month, and I'm really looking forward to it. I was on such an Avengers roll that I grabbed a few other ones out of my stack, one from Robert Ludwig, the most sane man among us, and two from the deep discount bins. That's Avengers Annual 16 and 17, and Avengers 502. That one was from the early 2000s. The annuals are interesting because even though they're only 1 year apart, they represent two completely different ways of doing annuals. 16 was a standalone that had no consequences, but a lot of action. It's a big battle story with the Grandmaster. And then 17 was one that was connected to one of the big Marvel epics, the Evolutionary War. And the first one, the big standalone with no consequences, that was a much more enjoyable read, at least here, 30-plus years later. Mike also sent a couple issues of reference-style books, including the official handbook of the Marvel Universe, Ohatmu, 4, and 6. And I confess here that maybe these were more of a skimming situation than an actual read. The best part was the cover of issue 4, which featured the letters D through G. Because even though the F and FFers were in that issue, as was the Fantasticar, the Pogo Plane, and the team's headquarters, they are nowhere on the cover. Absolutely nowhere. Good work, Jim Shooter. Good choice. And hail Doom. My buddy Chris Ouellette of Bizarre Manor spent some time during lockdown doing some household cleaning, including going through his comic book collection and downsizing. And he sent me some stuff, mostly stuff he'd gotten for free over the years, otherwise known as the best kind of comics. So glad to have you in the hashtag comic book circle of life, Chris. And among the books he sent were Free Comic Book Day 2007 Marvel Adventures. This was a split book, half Iron Man, half Hulk, both leading into the Marvel Adventures takes on those characters. Then we jump up about 10 years to Free Comic Book Day 2016, Bob's Burgers, Captain America, and Civil War. And I've never watched a second of Bob's Burgers, the animated TV show, but have found the couple of FCBD issues of the title that I've read to be pretty good, pretty funny, not reliant too much on inside information that as a naive reader I wouldn't have, and I appreciated that. Both of the Marvel books were good enough, but I think I lean toward the Cap book more. Just not a real fan, really, of any version of Marvel Civil War. That one, the Cap one, also had a Spidey backup. That was pretty good. Harley Quinn and the Suicide Squad, number 1. This was a special free edition released in conjunction with the movie. This sets up Harleen as the psychologist to the evildoers of the DC Universe, and ends up with her getting recruited by Amanda Waller to hang out with Captain Boomerang, Deadshot, Croc, and Katana. And on a related note, Free Comic Book Day 2020, if you didn't know, has turned into Free Comic Book Year 2020, with each store choosing how often to receive and display their free comics. And a couple of the stores that I went to last month had a few issues on display for pickup. And from those selections, I grabbed Archie, which is a pretty long story from the upcoming Betty and Veronica story called The Bond of Friendship by Jamie Lee Rotante, and more of a teaser preview of the upcoming Riverdale storyline based on the TV show. I dropped the show after the first season, and I'm not interested in comics based on the show, but the other one, the B&V story, different character designs, but I am intrigued by these modern takes on Archie and the gang. And Asterix by Paper Cuts. Along with Tintin, Asterix was a character I first encountered in sixth grade as a student at ISB, the International School of Bangkok. And I've been a fan of both characters for a long time. Was excited to see Paper Cuts collecting and releasing some of these original Asterix stories. And they even hinted at releasing new works from new creators. Now, that has me a bit nervous, the new stuff, I have to admit. But I'm so glad that these original stories are getting or potentially getting some modern American distribution. Canuck Beyond and Captain Battle from Chapter House way up there in Canada. Canuck Beyond is our beloved Captain Canuck, but Beyond, which I think is Canadian for extreme. These are books that I enjoy reading like once a year just to see what's going on. But I rarely, if ever, continue with the reading. I do find it kind of hard to find the books also. That's probably the situation this year too. Although, again, like usual, I thought both of these stories were pretty fun. And I certainly wish Chapter House, success. Dark Ark. This is a series that intrigues me in theory, but I haven't ever read any issues of. For one thing, it's not on Hoopla. That might be an Aftershock situation. But the concept of the series is that while Noah sailed to safety from the flood with all of the good animals on his ship, another ark, the Dark Ark, contained all the bad animals and monsters and fantasy beasts, etc. So obviously for me, an interesting, intriguing concept. Horizon Zero Dawn from the computer game that M loves. That's why I picked this up, to give to them. But you guys can't tell. Promise? Promise? I've never played the game, so I didn't know what was happening, but I was glad to pick it up to eventually pass it on. And from Pulp Reality, I picked up a few more issues of a Gold Key series that I read an issue of a while back. Trag and the Sky Gods, 2 and 5 from 1976. It's a story that has a nice combination of fantasy and sci-fi, aliens, and dinosaurs. Actually, speaking of Pulp Reality, didn't want to say this. I went into campus a few weeks ago for the first time in probably close to 2 months. And while I was in town, I did hit Pulp Reality, which is the used bookstore, record store, comic shop in the town where my campus is. Or it's more likely that going to campus was just the excuse I needed to give myself permission for the real purpose of the trip, which was to visit Pulp Reality and their many, many boxes of 50-cent comics. And if I wait more than a month or so between visits, which is much easier to do in the lockdown and COVID era, I run across a ton of stuff that I swear was not there the time before. And I went there this last time a couple of weeks ago with a budget. Not a modest one, I admit, $10. But I had to stop myself at $20. Otherwise, who knows how much I would have walked out of there with. But among those 40 comics that I did leave the store with were the Savage Sword of Conan magazine, 4 and 5. Again, these are the black and white, oversized productions from the mid-70s. Both of these were coverless, which is why I'm sure they ended up in the 50-cent bins. Each one had a rather long story, like 45 to 55 pages. And then a couple smaller ones, usually a couple pretty cool features. Issue 4 stands out for the illustrated story that it had, written and drawn by Gil Kane. That's a format I really like. I've heard some of my fellow comic book fans dismiss that form of storytelling. But I like it. This is the idea of the prose story with a few speech bubbles, maybe. Not really panels, but 4 or 5 different sized illustrations per page. And this one I thought was very enjoyable. But issue 5 was the class of this set with the story A Witch Shall Be Born, adapted by Roy Thomas and John Buscema from an original ERB story, epic in scope and very dynamic. And my LCS, World's Greatest Comics, had a super duper epic dime sale recently, and I picked up a bunch of Spideys and a bunch of Punishers and some other things too. But first, Peter Parker, Spider-Man, 17, 18, 21, 22, and 23. Some of these were by Howard Mackey, and some were from Paul Jenkins. This is right around 2000 or so. At this point, Mary Jane was thought missing in a plane accident of some kind, and that is weighing on Peter. He's been evicted from his apartment and is moving in with Robbie Robertson Jr. to save on rent. And as is often the case with Spidey stories, those moments, the moments with Peter dealing with his real life, those are the best parts. There was an issue with Sandman that had a lot of pathos, maybe a little too much, but it was dramatic. But he also faced, in one of these issues, a character named Typeface. Typeface? Not exactly a top-of-the-line villain. I mean, what the font were they thinking? and The Amazing Spider-Man Renew Your Vows, 10 and 11. This was a strange little Elseworld type of setup. Pete, MJ, and daughter Annie May are all heroes. And in these issues, their main rogue is Normie Osborn. Not Norman, not Harry, but Harry's kid, Normie, who's about the same age as Annie May, about 10. But instead of being a superhero, which I understand is pretty unbelievable for a 10-year-old, he is, in fact, the CEO of Oscorp, which for a 10-year-old is even just a little bit more unbelievable and even more weird. So I'm not really sure what to make of these issues, but for a dime each, they were bargains. And Punisher, 13, 20, 23, and 24. This is a character I've read just a few dozen issues of, but for a dime apiece, kind of had to grab a bunch of them, I thought. And these are in the same run as the last batch that I read with Mike Barron writing. So I recognized some of the side characters, some of the locations. I remember the action at the Ninja Training School, which is right where 23 and 24 pick up from. There are a few bits that got repetitive, like giving his origin story every single issue, in dialogue or in narration. But enjoyable reads, and Barron knows what he's doing when he's writing Frank Castle. I need to mention a book sent to me by Kirk Spencer at this point, an issue from later in this run, Punisher 64, written by Abnett and Lanning. It was the start of a long story arc, so you get the drama of it all getting going. And it also took place in London, and that was a nice change of pace, change of place for a Punisher story. And Gru the Wanderer, 48 through 50. Three terrific issues of this terrific series. I really enjoy these. They're smart, they're funny, and more importantly, they're consistently smart and funny. One of the absolute best humor comics ever. And again, from that dime sale, I read Robin 3000, 1 and 2. I mean, come on. What could go wrong? It's a prestige format series. It's an Elseworld story, and it's really cheap. Wow, that was a score. Except, wow, this was suboptimal. I ran these books by Rob Myers, the Robin guy, and he allowed us how at a quarter of piece, I would have slightly overpaid. And that's a fan saying this. Wow. Now, I am a fan of the artist, fellow Ohioan P. Craig Russell, and his work, the art, was definitely the best part of these. And those of you who know me as a story-first, almost story-only person, when the only thing I can praise about two prestige format extra-size books is the art, just let my silence about the story speak volumes. I mentioned Crazy Comics earlier, the black-owned shop here in Columbus. And from their dollar boxes, I picked up Gatecrasher, Ring of Fire 1 and 2. And then from the ongoing, Gatecrasher 1 and 2. These are from the talented trio of Wade, Connor, and Palmiotti from around the year 2000. So you have a high school student, Alec Wagner, who is half alien, and thus he has the power to jump through interdimensional gates, that's the Gatecrasher part, and has been recruited by the Split Second Squad to be a protector of the Earth from alien invasion, which is a pretty cool after-school job, except that sometimes it becomes a during-school job, and it does interrupt things like, you know, prom. So good story, good character. I kind of liked where this was going. And from Derek Crabb of the History of Comics on Film YouTube series, I read three issues of a black-and-white manga-style series from Eternity Comics from 1990, Captain Harlock 1, 3, and 8. These were new American stories based on the anime My Youth in Arcadia, or possibly Vengeance of the Space Pirate, depending on the translation. The setup is solid. Earth of the 30th century has lost a war, and now lives as slaves, except for the pirate Harlock and his crew of idealistic outcasts who live in the sea of stars, but keep a close eye on Earth, always looking for a chance to set those people free. Derek also sent from the mid-90s Superboy 48, 49, and 50, which was a more interesting title than I expected. I didn't love everything in these issues, but I appreciated how inventive and bold they were. Barbara Kiesel wrote 48 and 49, and 48 starts off like a regular comic, and then Superboy disappears in a flash of lightning at the end. And he doesn't appear in 49. It's the supporting cast and all of their efforts in the month that has passed since his disappearance to find him. And then in 50, we do get back to the kid who has found himself in a Commandy-style world, and they even give Jack Kirby credit for inspiration. Such a strange trio of issues, but also fascinating. I also hooplaed the next trade in a series I started earlier last year, Moonshine, 13 through 17, from the creative team of Brian Azzarello and Eduardo Risso, who gave us, well, gave me in particular, the excellent Vertigo series, 100 Bullets. This one, similarly, is a crime story and has lots of blood and sex and violence, but it differs from 100 Bullets in that it is a period piece taking place in the West Virginia hills during Prohibition. That's the kickoff of the series, as a matter of fact. A New York mobster sends Lou Perlow, one of his top men, to the mountain to take over the operations of what is widely considered to be the best moonshine in the East. What Perlow doesn't know is that the family behind it all are werewolves. And in this trade, he learns firsthand what it is to be a werewolf, and he experiences some other backwoods magic. It's a wild, weird, and fascinating story. Look, I fully admit my bias, in that I'm a fan of Azzarello, and when Rizzo brings his ideas to life, I'm an even bigger fan. I like this, but I don't recommend it exactly, because your experiences may vary, but for me, when I like something from these guys, I really, really like it. Another series I continued via Hoopla was The Woods, 13 through 20. Here, James Tynan IV is taking us into a power struggle, both within our crew of students that we've been following, and also between those characters and the pre-existing communities, the folks who are swept up and swept over to this location over the prior decades, maybe centuries. And in these issues, we have true loss, true consequences, but also true friendship and signs of true hope. Overall, I'm impressed by how we've gotten here from where we started, which was sort of a light, or at least not nearly this dark, vaguely fantasy adventure type of story. But this has moved so far away from that. And in a really impressive way, I'd say. I expect to read another trade or two of this next month. Really interested to see where The Woods heads next. I also picked up the next trade of a Hoopla run that I've been reading, but because it's Marvel, it got renumbered. So after reading She-Hulk 7 through 11 last month, which was actually called just Hulk for the first trade to add to the confusion, the numbering jumped, so after issue 11, we jumped to She-Hulk 159 to 163, something about legacy numbering. This is the Jen Walters Must Die storyline, in which the leader decides to take down She-Hulk, and he uses a college professor to do that, which I find to be a personal attack. This is what hashtag Big Comic does when you disagree with their treatment of a certain Latverian leader. They come after you personally. Anyway, in these, the interactions with Hellcat have become a highlight of this run as they were in this volume. And although I like Jennifer as an attorney, her run at her new firm was destined to end uglily, and it did in this last issue. I enjoy realism in comics and understand why it's hard to imagine Jennifer actually making a career for herself at a big law firm, with all that being Jennifer Walters and She-Hulk entails. But I was bummed that it didn't work out for her here. Although, again, it makes perfect real-world or realistic sense that it wouldn't, that it couldn't work. And another Archie Reed from Hoopla, a concept that we talked about last time when one of these stories appeared in a digester, maybe two of them did, but I read the rest of them in a digital collection. Archie's Explorers of the Unknown 1 through 6. And yes, this is a total, complete homage to Challengers of the Unknown. The framing sequence of someone in the Archie cast, at first Archie, then eventually others, including Mr. Lodge and Principal Weatherby, reading a book about the Explorers of the Unknown and commenting about how so many of the characters remind the readers of Archie and the gang. And then we get the story with the Archie characters taking those roles. So, of course, Archie is Red, the leader, with Betty as the driver and mechanic, Dilton as the tech guy, Moose as the muscle. Even Reggie's on the team as a demolitions expert. And Veronica and Jughead are even on the team. Even Chuck Clayton is. He and his strange-looking, as in exactly like Doctor Strange-looking, cloak of invisibility. The Archie Adventure books have a smaller following than do the teen hijinks stories, but they can be a really great change of pace. I really enjoyed these. As for my tastes, they hit a very good balance between funny and adventure, between homage for the Archie character types and 1960s adventure comic books. I'd not run across any of these stories before, you know, until last month, and they were a very pleasant discovery. And that was a lot, but I think that's everything. In terms of my favorite reads of August, the Asterix Free Comic Book Day was exciting. Gru is always a hoot. Some of the John Carters were fun. And Archie, cast as the Challengers of the Unknown, that was fun. But in terms of what I thought was my favorite, I mean, look, we've had this situation a few times before with certain books, and it certainly applies here. And that's to say that any month where I read 100 Bullets, there's a really good chance that's going to be my favorite read of the month. And it was this time. And specifically, I'll say the first issue of the second arc. My favorite read of August, 100 Bullets, number 4. Next month, I'm not really sure what I'm going to be reading, other than another Avengers Vision trade. Some more of the Woods. Other than that, who knows? But whatever I do end up reading, I will be here to talk about the books I read during September, and that episode ought to be out sometime in early October. And don't worry, next month's episode should be a lot smaller. 4 weeks of Saturdays instead of 5, and back to full-time teaching for the whole month. Feel free to let me know what you think of this episode, what you think of any of the comics that I mentioned, especially if you've read any of them, any of the many, many books that I've mentioned. You can send that feedback via email at relativelygeeky@gmail.com, or as a comment on the Facebook and blog post for the episode. The blog is at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com. You can follow the network on Twitter at relatively_geek. And, of course, the network has its own page on Facebook as well. Come join us. All are welcome. Thanks for listening, and keep the pages turning.